It's been clicked. You sound like you're dying slowly.
I am not dying. I am sick, though. I don't know if I am sick with COVID or what. But at this point, they are saying just assume everyone who's sick has COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I did that
thing. I don't know where you would have gotten it from, though.
I have no idea where I would have gotten anything from. I don't go anywhere except the grocery store, and that's like once a week. So I guess the grocery store. That's probably the answer to my question. Yeah, I'm sick. I got sick a couple of days ago. I took a COVID, like coughing, fever, runny nose, felt terrible. Took a COVID test at home. It came up negative, which of course means go take a real COVID test. Like, it doesn't mean anything. And so now I am just waiting until I can have my scheduled COVID tests. Why? Because you can't, like, everyone's getting COVID tests right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This has been COVID Chat with Phil and Willow.
I just got my booster, so I'm fine.
You just got your, well, I mean, I'm fully vaccinated. I'm fully boostered. Which is probably why, if this is COVID, I just feel lousy. I just kind of feel lousy. But I am quarantined from the rest of my family in this room all day. Like, I can't leave. People bring me food. It's nuts. Which also means that I have spent the time watching movies while I'm in here. Would you like to know what I've watched?
Sure.
All right. I have watched, since I've been quarantined, I watched the original Skyline.
Don't know what that is.
It's a terrible sci-fi movie from 2010 that I was like, people were like, you got to watch Skyline because the sequels are good. So I forced myself to watch Skyline. It was bad. I watched Thief by Michael Mann. It was very good. I watched The Keep by Michael Mann. It was okay. I watched L.A. Takedown by Michael Mann. It was fascinating. And then I watched Heat by Michael Mann. It was incredible. There's a lot of movies. It's a lot of Michael Mann. I've just been watching a lot of Michael Mann movies.
I have no idea how you can sit through so many movies.
Because I have nothing else to do while I am stuck in this
room. Video games to play?
I could play. I don't have the energy. Like, I can lay on the bed and watch a movie. I don't have the energy a lot of times to like play a video game. I'm getting tired just like from being alive.
That's not any different than usual, though.
No, it's no different than usual. This is a movie that we have announced several times but never watched because we keep doing other things. What is this week's movie?
Road Warrior. The Road Warrior.
Mad Max 2.
I've heard a dog gets shot in this one, so I'm not looking forward to it.
Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. We've got information about that dog. It's a beautiful story. But Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, which is funny because you've never seen Mad Max 1.
No.
But you don't have to. It's okay. Mad Max 1. Well, okay. George Miller directed the Mad Maxes, all four of them. Directed Happy Feet, about a penguin. Also directed Babe 2. George Miller is a fascinating guy. He is a doctor. He made his first short films while he was studying medicine and completed his residency and everything. He's a medical doctor.
The time.
You what?
Who has that kind of time?
It was Australia. What are you going to do? Australian guy became a medical doctor, teamed up with his brother and a friend of theirs, started a production company, and wrote and directed his first movie, Mad Max, released in 1979. It became kind of a cult hit. He wasn't that pleased with how it turned out because he didn't have the money or the time, and it was really hectic and kind of a pain in the butt to make. So when it came time to make his next movie, he made a sequel that sort of served as a new jumping off point for Mad Max, called Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. But because no one in America saw Mad Max 1, Mad Max 2 was just released as The Road Warrior in America. And it was dubbed into American English from Australian, which is why...
We're not watching the dubbed one, are we?
No, we're not. Yeah, the dubbed one's hard to find. But it's why the America's first exposure to Mel Gibson, for most people, was dubbed over with some guy who just sounded like this. Because they thought his accent was too thick, which is funny because I believe Mad Max has 14 lines of dialogue in this whole movie. And most of it doesn't matter because this is an almost silent film, according to, I mean, not silent, but it's a George Miller wanted to make movies that were just watchable without even having to worry about the dialogue. It told their own story. He made movies about cars because he said at the time he made the first movie, car culture in Australia was pretty much like gun culture in America. Meaning that by the time he was a young man, he had already lost several friends to car accidents just because Australians would just kill each other with their cars. He said there was a lot of like straight roads and not a whole lot going on. So people just drove very fast. And he was a doctor, so he saw a lot of people killed by car accidents. And he wanted to make a movie just about how dangerous cars were. With the first movie and how they could be used as weapons as well. So not glorifying it, but sort of like, this is dangerous, y'all. Like, you could kill people with cars. And then he made Mad Max 2, which is basically like, cars are dangerous. Also, I now have a lot of money, more money, and we can create some spectacular stunts. Mel Gibson, you've probably heard of him from the movie.
I've heard he's a piece of work.
Raging anti-Semite and yeah. Racist. Understandable, considering his father was also a raging anti-Semite and racist. They're from, his father was like the head of like a ultra-conservative Catholic sect, who one of those bizarre Catholic sects that were like Vatican II doesn't exist, who thought that the Pope was like evil. Like, raging Catholic, but also, strangely enough, 1968's Jeopardy champion, which is a whole other thing. His father was a quiz show master, like won quiz shows left and right.
I guess you can never truly know a person, huh?
But, you know, a dangerous racist because he's also incredibly smart. Mm-hmm. Like that kind of person, like really well educated, really well spoken, who's on a lot of chat shows. Mel Gibson, born in America, moved to Australia when he was 12, raised there, became an actor. And people were like, how did this, if this Mel Gibson guy was such a raging racist and anti-Semite, how did he get so popular? And people were like, oh, because he was also really nice and super charming. Like, even people who hated him were like, man, I talked to Mel Gibson for like 15 minutes and I just can't stop loving that guy. So to answer your question, because he's a movie star and he has that quality. Like, people just like him. They're around him and they're like, I just like this guy. And they're like, well, you know, he's a horrible person. And you're like, yeah, but I really like this guy. And that kind of shows in the movies. You're like, yeah, he knows how to work a camera. Like, he knows how to be in front of a camera. Regardless, at the time this movie was made, nobody knew any of that about Mel Gibson. He was just handsome man, trademark, and super charming. And then he went on to do the Lethal Weapons when he came to America. Went on to just become the face that everyone loved. And then he started losing it in the early 2000s. And that was well after the era we are dealing with here. We're dealing with just Mel Gibson, some guy. Just some guy.
He's just some guy.
So to catch you up on what's happened in the story thus far, Mel Gibson plays a guy named Max.
Yeah.
Who is mad. Yep. Angry at his name is Max Rokitansky. He was a cop. The first movie took place a few years in the future. There's biker gangs and automobile gangs, and there's one that Max is going after. They kill his family. Mm-hmm. He gets revenge at the very end and kills the whole gang. And now the second movie takes place even further in the future. Things in Australia have gotten even worse as far as like drought and the energy problem, and that's basically where it is. Like, the first movie is just a revenge fantasy, and the second movie is actually like, okay, now we're getting like, it's more, a little more sci-fi, a little more post-apocalyptic, and that's Mad Max. That's all you need to know.
I needed to know even less than that, actually.
You needed to know, you actually honestly did, because the movie catches you up right at the beginning.
But also I mean, they're kind of all just standalone movies.
They are kind of all just standalone movies.
Absolutely zero context for the other one.
That's right, because you saw Fury Road, which is 4. Mm-hmm. The first Mad Max movie I ever saw was 3, Beyond Thunderdome. And yeah, I was like, I know what's going on. This guy walks in and then stuff happens. Because he's just kind of the man with no name. He just kind of wanders into situations and there he is, and he deals with things without saying much. Unlike Lethal Weapon, where he says a lot. He says a whole lot. And then Danny Glover says, "I am getting too old for this stuff." I'm not going to ask if you're ready for this because I know you have very low expectations.
I have no expectations.
Well, fantastic. That's great. That's a good way to go in. I am going to be happy to not be recording for a while because my voice is now done. So why don't you go grab something to drink? I'll go sit here because I can't leave this room. I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro, Toro time.
I had a really cool lecture on Friday on medieval weaponry.
Yeah.
It was very cool. And you know what else had a lot of weapons in it?
What had a lot of weapons?
This movie that we're going to talk about.
Did it have medieval weapons?
Kind of.
Kind of?
It didn't have like historically accurate medieval weaponry, but
why would it? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, the whole point of this movie is that everything they use and wear and ride around on is logically, they could logically have found and or scavenged it.
This movie is marketed towards several demographics, and I'm not part of any of them.
I don't know if this movie was actually marketed toward any different. I don't think George Miller considered
I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. This movie is appealing to several demographics, and I'm not a single one of them.
Yeah, it's not exactly in your wheelhouse. This isn't like something where you're like, "What am I?" You're not at the video store, sort of scanning through all the titles and being like, "I'm looking for something post-apocalyptic with a lot of scantily clad leather men hitting each other with cars and maybe a wolf boy throwing a razor sharp boomerang."
No, this movie had nothing in it that appealed to me. Except for the snake. The snake was pretty cool.
You liked the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
You liked the idea of flying around in a little one-seat helicopter.
Yeah, it's called a gyrocopter,
mm-hmm.
not a helicopter.
You were enthusiastic about the gyrocopter. Do not lie to me.
Yeah, it's part of the snake.
Yeah, it's part of the snake. A gyrocopter, scientifically, is part of a snake.
It is part of the snake, because the snake got thrown from the gyrocopter.
I would say the snake is probably part of the gyrocopter.
Nope. The snake was the real MVP of this movie.
The snake was one of the... How about dog?
Dog was pretty good, too.
Dog was pretty good.
Although I'm not really a dog person.
You're not a dog person, but but you have to admit, dog was lovely.
Mm-hmm. Until it died.
Spoilers, dog dies. Ladies and gentlemen, we are, of course, back, and we're talking about Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, which we watched, and which... Mm-hmm. I will say, as per our usual character arc throughout this podcast, you ended up appreciating it more than you thought you would.
Which isn't a high bar to pass.
Right. You thought it was going to be absolutely loathsome.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it was only a little loathsome.
There are aspects of the movie that I find, if they made it today, they certainly wouldn't show and do what they did. George Miller certainly wouldn't.
You know what this movie was? It was just an extension of that biker gang fight in whatever that other movie was called.
Which whatever movie?
The one movie was the only other movie we watched that has a biker gang fight in it.
A biker gang fight. What did we watch that had a biker gang fight in it?
It was like the fourth configuration or something.
Oh, the ninth configuration.
Yeah.
That's right. There were elements of that in the ninth
configuration.
It was
just a really long version of that, which, you know, wasn't my favorite part of that movie.
Okay, but it didn't have the cringe aspect of the ninth configuration's biker scene.
I disagree.
I feel like because Mad Max 2 exists in a world in which we accept that that biker gang exists, as opposed to ninth configuration, which is supposed to take place in a relatively realistic version of our world, that biker scene came out of nowhere. The biker scene in Mad Max 2 comes out of nowhere, but because it's the entire movie, you're just like, where'd this movie come from?
Yeah, and then you're like, get it away from me. That's how I felt while I was watching it.
There is, looking at this movie and looking at Fury Road, one of the things they talk about when Fury Road came out was that there's a lot of implied history of sexual violence in Fury Road, but that's not what the movie is about. It's about the liberation mm-hmm. of the women. from that situation. And but it doesn't go out of its way to shock you with that. However, Mad Max 2 does, and Mad Max 1 do go out of their way to shock you with the threat of sexual violence and the portrayal of sexual violence. And it's one of those things that I feel like happened a lot in the 70s and 80s in movies to sort of show you just how bad things got, that now I look at and I'm like, you know what? We probably figured out these guys were bad guys simply by the fact that they are the bad guy. They are essentially Skeletor's henchmen riding around in ghoulie mobiles. And all of their lines are spoken as histrionic screams.
I think there's a problem in a lot of media where murder isn't considered evil by the audience.
Right.
Because, I don't know, it's just, it's the shock of murder on screen isn't as shocking because we all know it's fake. Like, there's, you know, suspension of disbelief, but watching a fictional villain kill someone, we know that they haven't actually killed anyone.
Plus, and I think you see your hero killing people as well.
Yeah, and I think that they tried to get around that by portraying sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
But once you have to start bringing that into your movies, maybe your villains aren't as foundationally solid as you think they are. If you have to show your villain raping someone, then maybe you should work on writing your villain a bit better.
And I will say that if you could cut those moments out of this movie, the villains wouldn't have been any less intimidating. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't, yeah. I guess what I was trying to say is it was unnecessary. It leaves a weird taste in your mouth. You're like, for a tasteless movie already, like a movie that revels in the bad taste of the villains and even the heroes, like everyone looks, they dress like they came from outer space. They're all wearing cobbled together costumes, cobbled together living spaces, cobbled together complexions and ideas. There's just that threat doesn't need to be portrayed. Yeah. And I feel like Fury Road answered that. It was like, right, you don't need to show that. We understand this is a crap sack world.
If your heroes and your villains are so much the same that you need to separate them with sexual violence, then maybe you have a problem with your hero.
Maybe. Mad Max is certainly a problematic hero. I don't think he's not supposed to be a problematic hero.
Mm-hmm.
He's what they call the anti-hero. Yeah.
I just think that if you're going to have an anti-hero, go all in with the anti-hero. Don't try and make your villain so much worse.
Right.
Because that takes away from the anti-hero nature of it all.
Well said. Well, speaking of anti-hero, speaking of Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, or as it was known in America, again, The Road Warrior. This is a weird movie. I would say the Mad Max series is a weird series. It is a series in which no single movie asks for a follow-up. Each follow-up is pretty much a standalone film that contradicts all the previous films. And the character of Max becomes less and less relevant to the story. He's just sort of the cipher. He is
the Mandalorian. He's the guy who just happens to be there when things are going down,
right, and who helps out if it suits him, and then in the end has a change of heart and helps out because it's the right thing to do, and then he can't live with himself anymore, and then he leaves. That's like the plot of it's that story.
There's nothing wrong with that story.
George Miller literally read Hero with a Thousand Faces and wrote the movie.
Yeah, I think that I brought up the hero arc while we were watching it. I was like, this is just the template.
Which, you know, there's a reason it's a popular template, because it works. You don't have to.
It's not even that it's a popular template. It's just that this is how stories are written.
Right. And what's amazing about this is, like, the story itself, the series, the movie is just a series of action sequences that are loosely tied together by this simple concept of Mad Max is trying to help, for his own purposes, trying to help a colony of people get from point A to point B, or even from trying to get from point A to point A 0.5. Like,
it's like a D&D campaign that I wouldn't want to play in.
Which you could have played if you had gotten the Palladium series Roadhogs, which is basically, if you wanted to play Mad Max, you bought the Roadhogs module, and it had all, it was only about souping up vehicles in post-apocalyptic worlds and how to have post-apocalyptic vehicle fights in Playdium role-playing series. It was compatible with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles After the Bomb. I owned that module, but we never used it, but I did read it a lot. That was actually probably my first introduction to the world of the Road Warrior, was the Roadhogs Palladium game module for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Other Strangeness.
Did everyone play as turtles, or did they play as different creatures?
No, you chose your... Theoretically, you were supposed to roll for your animal. There was a very complex chart on how you rolled for your animal, because there were countless numbers of animals. And so you theoretically would roll. You could choose your own animal, because you would roll, and half the time you'd get, like, duck. And you're like, well, you're limited by that. And then you'd have
That sounds awesome.
But then you'd have to roll for how mutated you were. Mm. And, like, some were, like, basically, you know, for everywhere from
just a duck.
From basically just a duck to essentially a person with a few duck-like qualities. Like,
singular duck.
So you could be stuck as, like, I am a moth that's mostly moth. And you're like, well, this... And now you're just playing this guy who's like, well, you got to figure out how to be...
Just a moth.
How to be part of the team. I don't think it actually went that extreme. But, like, you get what I'm saying. Like, you could roll a character you're stuck with and you're like, I have no passion for this.
That's where the creativity comes in.
Yeah, but in D&D, don't you get to choose your character?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, you can. If you don't want to be an elf, you don't have to be an elf. If you're like, oh man, come on, kangaroo, and you roll, and it's like hamster again.
That'd be fantastic. Sounds awesome.
So the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles role playing game was very fun.
I'd rather watch a movie about ninja hamsters than Mad Max Road. I'm sure there is a movie about ninja hamsters.
There was a comic book called Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters that was a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles ripoff that actually got its own line. So yes, if you want ninja hamsters,
a Hamtaro screen cap is one of the first things that comes up.
So Mad Max 2. Let's talk about Mad Max 2.
Yeah, keep talking about ninja hamsters.
Mad Max 2. It is a series of chases from point A to point B, from point B back to point A, from point A to point B, and then from point B back to point A.
Whole movie takes place in like a 20 mile area.
Yeah, it's very, very localized. Max comes across, it starts off with Max coming across a tanker truck that is full of dead people. And he's there to get the gasoline out of just the truck's engines. And like, it's just a big rig, like not a full tanker. It's just the front end of an 18 wheeler, the tractor. And he's set upon by a gang who he fights off. And he gets the gas, and then he comes across our gyrocopter pilot who tries to ambush him, but he captures the gyrocopter pilot.
Pilot has the most lines in this whole movie.
He does. He has the most lines. He has the most character development. They form an uneasy alliance, by which I mean Mad Max takes him hostage, is going to murder him, but the gyrocopter guy is like, I know a place that has a ton of gasoline, and it's this... like a refinery. It's a makeshift refinery that has makeshift walls around it, run by a group of people who have a huge tanker truck, or just tank, full of gasoline. And it is being set upon by this evil biker gang that are basically holding, like, surrounding it. What do you call it? Siege. It's been under siege by this biker gang. And so the gyrocopter guy is like, if we can get in there, we can steal that, or somehow steal gasoline from there. That's our plan of sticking with it. They witness the colony sending out some scouts in different directions who are set upon by the biker gang. This is where the sexual assault comes in. Mm-hmm. But Max, quote-unquote, saves one of the people from death and is going to use him as a bargaining chip to get into the refinery colony and trade this guy for gas for his car so that he can just get out of there. And that's kind of the setup of the entire plot. There is this city under siege, evil biker gang, and who are led by Lord Humongous.
It's a dumb name.
I think it's an awesome name because it's so stupid.
I think it's dumb.
Lord Humongous and his sidekick. What's the guy's name? Gex? Gak? Gaxplat? What's the guy's name?
Which guy?
The main guy with the
big mohawk guy?
With the big mohawk. His name is Wes. Sorry. His name is Wes, who is Lord Humongous' second in command. And so what you end up with is Max at this place, sort of held. Initially, he's held by this group of people. There is the leader of this group named Papagayo.
Whatever.
And Max kind of becomes, for a while, kind of the toady of this group. And in the same way that Wes is kind of the toady of Lord Humongous. Like, they become kind of mirror images of each other.
Except they're for... they're both being led by really annoying guys. I find the leader of the oil people very annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. Papagallo, played by Mike Preston. Yeah, there's the none of the people in this show acquit themselves very, like, they all come off a little bit as
self-righteous.
A little bit. I mean, you got to think that they are
driven.
They are living in under pretty dire straits. They're not in the best of situations here. So we have just our basic characters. We have Mel Gibson playing Max, Mad Max. We have Dog playing Dog. You want to tell us a little bit about Dog?
Dog is cute. Dog is angry. Dog is dead.
I thought you were going to say Dog is cute. Let us thank him for our food. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
No.
No, Dog is adorable. And I mean, I have a little info here on Dog.
You can tell that they didn't have the CGI techniques that we do for dogs back then, because the dog's tail is wagging the entire time, like a
His
happy boy.
Yeah. So they auditioned over 100 dogs for the role, because George Miller just had an idea of what this... He wanted to be an authentically Australian cattle dog.
This has to be an Australian dog.
And because there's, I guess, this is a very Australian movie. He wanted to just look right. Like, it had to look like the right kind of dog. So they went to this pound. There was a bunch of dogs there. One of the dogs was scheduled to be put down, put to sleep the next day. And George Miller threw a rock. Not at the dog. He just threw a rock. And the dog ran and grabbed it and brought it back to him. And George Miller and the casting director were like, this is our perfect dog. Because the dog really wants to live. And he obviously wants to be part of this movie. Of course, later on, they were like, yeah, that dog just, that's what he does. He catches rocks and he brings them back to people. Which I love. Like, that's what a dog does. But the RSPCA rule said the dog had to be fixed before it could leave the pound. But they were like, we don't want a fixed dog. We want this dog to have all of its bits and pieces so that it looks like a wild dog. The dog was afraid of all the engine noise on the set. So they had to stuff its ears with cotton so it wouldn't be afraid. The dog was so friendly it wouldn't attack anyone, so they had to train it to play really aggressively so that it would look like it was attacking people. So every time you see the dog, it's just very excited to be playing with people. And after the filming was done, everyone wanted to buy the dog. But he ended up being adopted by the stunt coordinator, Max Aspen, and his wife, Dale, who was the animal handler and trainer. And one of the stunt people, and the dog was unhappy not being able to work, so they just kept the dog doing what dogs do, working on a farm, herding animals, rounding up the animals, and eventually he was passed on to another stunt person, Gary Gausla, and he died in the care of Gary, lived out the rest of his days perfectly happy.
Good.
So, unlike what happens to Dog in the movie,
not shot with a hand crossbow.
Nope.
Wrist crossbow.
Shot. What?
Wrist crossbow.
Yeah, there's a lot of crossbows in this movie.
Where did they get all of these crossbows? And where did they get the bolts for the crossbows? Are there a lot of crossbows in Australia?
Yes, it's an entirely crossbow based economy. I think what they cool is the bolts for the crossbows are clearly just metal rods. Like they are repurposed metal rods. And the cool thing about crossbows, of course, or bows and arrows, but mostly crossbows, is that the rods are short. They're still effective, and you can use them again. Like, you just pull them out of a person. They're just metal rods. A bow and arrow, of course, has to be aerodynamic and large enough to use. But a crossbow, they have, like you said, they have these little wrist launchers that are, you know, they're not going to most likely kill you, but they're going to put you out of commission. Yeah. Unless you're that guy at the beginning who gets shot with a crossbow and then pulls it out of his arm. Yarr. Which brings up one of the big questions about this movie. And so
how are these guys not covered in road rash?
How are these guys not dying of infections every second of the day? Yeah. One of my friends said when I mentioned online that we were going to be covering Mad Max 2, and I said, anyone have anything we want us to talk about? And besides the dog, which was the first thing people said, please talk about the dog, who's amazing. One of my friends, Alex, said the weird idea that a world running out of fuel has somehow spurred a lawless society that plunders fuel to power its junk cars just so the drivers can plunder more fuel. Like, what's the end game here? And I'm like, at this point in the storyline, this is a story of fuel acquisition. And no question is ever given to water acquisition. It's a movie that's set in the desert, in the post-apocalypse, and water is not an issue for anyone. No one
talks
about it.
That's what we said the entire time we were watching this movie.
Yeah. It's
all
about
sweaty
gasoline
all the time.
And as you said, I think, like, why don't they just ride those camels? There's camels in this movie. Just ride the camels and this whole problem goes away. You won't have to worry about getting fuel and you can focus on other things. Obviously, George Miller said this is not meant to represent reality or what he believes would actually happen in a post-apocalypse. It's meant to it's a fairy tale, and it's meant to illustrate, you know, like the sort of like irrational desperation of human beings in times of great of want. It's
maybe
also coming on the tail end of the energy crisis. Remember, end of 1970s, people literally waited in line for hours just to get a tank of gas.
I don't remember this because I wasn't even a concept.
Do you remember the Carter administration, Willow? Do you remember the 1970s?
No, you don't remember the 1970s.
I have in distinct memory of weeping on my aunt's shoulder because I was asked at the age of 2 if I wanted to go see the movie Star Wars. And I was so scared of my sister's Chewbacca sheets that I started crying and saying no, 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 and being held by my aunt because I did not want to go see Star Wars. And there is a photograph of me crying in my aunt's arms because I did not want to go see Star Wars, a decision I regret to this day because I couldn't see Star Wars during its original run. What?
What's the difference between seeing it then and seeing it now?
Because then I could have said I saw Star Wars in its original run. As it stands, I only saw Empire and Jedi in their original run. I was terrified of my sister's Chewbacca sheets. They weren't just Chewbacca sheets. They were full Star Wars sheets. But as a little kid, I kept seeing Chewbacca and being like, I don't want to see the movie with the angry dog man.
Wow, you really changed your tune when I was younger.
Also, she had Wizard of Oz wallpaper.
Yeah.
And I was scared of the flying monkeys on the wallpaper. Not the flying monkeys in the movie. I was fine with those. But the wallpaper flying monkeys. And then once I was in her room at night, because I would just like sometimes like sleep on the floor there because I was scared of the dark. And my sister was awake. And we were both awake. And Toto in the wallpaper started crawling across the wall. And it was a roach. But we thought it was Toto at first. My sister was like, Toto's moving. And I was like, what? And then we were like, it's a roach. And that scared us more than if Toto had actually been moving. Tales of Stacy's bedroom.
What were we talking about?
Do you have any stories about haunted wallpaper?
I guess when we lived in the duplex, I had all those Harry Potter posters.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember those? They were like from a book or something.
Yeah.
And at night in the darkness, it looked like they were popping out of the walls. Mm-hmm. Just faces, like
very much like in the movie
stuff.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, except for they were scary. But eventually it was fine because I was like, well, I haven't died yet, so I guess it's okay.
That's how I get through every day of my life. That's my motto.
But the scariest thing in my room, remember the light fixture in there had three It had three lights, little like round light holder thingies. Well, after we watched the Empty Child episode of Doctor Who, that looked like a gas mask.
Uh-huh.
And I kept getting really scared of it because of that.
Good. I was a good dad. Doctor Who's a children's show. It's a children's show for babies.
I did watch the last two episodes of Torchwood with you way before I should have.
Way before
you should have. You're freaky. You're freaky AF.
Torchwood is not a children's show. I was a bad dad. I was a bad dad.
You're a great father. We watched a lot of, what was it, Smallville, too.
We did watch a lot of Smallville. I mean, I was just a bad father.
Remember the first time we watched the first episode of Smallville and it terrified me so much?
Yes, because the first episode of Smallville is unusually terrifying compared to the rest of the series. It's like they were like, let's make a Superman show. What should we do? What's the first thing we should do? Terrify all the viewers tuning into this Superman show. You know, Superman, that comic book character famous for the horror stories that it's about.
You know, let's just have a guy shed his skin and kill his mother. It's fine.
It's fine. What a great way to begin. They were trying to be Buffy. That was back when every show was trying to be Buffy. And so it was like, it's a show about Superman. What's it going to be about? Monsters and supernatural demons attacking high schoolers. Great. That's what every show's about right now.
I did watch a lot of Buffy, too, which is appropriate because it's my namesake. Anyways, what were we talking about?
That it's weird that these people are after gasoline so much. If they would stop being after gasoline, the story would just resolve itself.
I don't even think like the good guys were even after the gasoline. They just had it. Like, because they had a good thing going. They were just like chickens and pigs and chilling.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know why they needed the gas. They could have just been like, you know what? Take the gas.
It. We're here. We're fine. We're raising our chickens. Mm-hmm. I think what it was you need the gasoline to get around. Okay. It's Australia. Australia is a huge country. It's enormous. Mm-hmm. And most of it is uninhabitable. Most of it is, or I won't say uninhabitable. I will say incredibly hostile to living creatures. Anything beyond very dry lizards and scorpions. I mean, obviously, the indigenous people of Australia lived there, but it wasn't an easy life. It was a very difficult life. And Australia has coasts that are very inhabitable, like easily inhabitable. And then it has the outback, which is most of Australia.
Oh, that's right. They needed the gas to power up their stuff so they could get to the coast.
So they're trying to get to the coast. And you have found a spot where you can drill and get crude oil, I guess, and refine it into gasoline. How are they doing that? Doodly, magic. Doodly, doodly. They were just doing it. They were making their own gasoline.
They had that one engineer dude who couldn't use his legs. He was cool.
As we know from Back to the Future 3, it's very hard to make gasoline, as Doc Brown said. You can't just get crude oil and turn it into gas. It's hard, but they were doing it. So they were they weren't planning on living there. It was like a temporary way station, but then they were discovered by the biker gang, or as they say in Australia, the bikies. My favorite thing about Australia is that what we would call like a biker or a surfer, they're bikies and surfies, which makes the podcast I listen to, Case File, which is an Australian true crime podcast, hilarious when it's a very serious situation. It's like, and then they were set upon by another gang of bikies. You're like, bikies? That's adorable. Why are you calling them bikies? That's what they call bikers. Biker gang members. Bikies, surfies. There's another one too. Skaties or something. Like, there's people like, what we would put an ER on, they would put an EY on, and it is choice. So they're under siege by Lord Humongous and his Jason. Gang of... He's Walmart wearing a hockey Jason. Mask. He's all deformed underneath the hockey mask. So yes, he is. He is Jason with like a German accent. There's apparently George Miller wrote novel length backstories for each of these characters that he's never like revealed. He just wrote them and I guess shared them with the actors. Like, here's your character's full story. Here is who Lord Humongous is and why he is. And why he does what he does. You will understand it. The audience doesn't need to know this. You just need to perform it so well that they understand that there's something else going on with this guy. And I think that's one of the strengths of this film is that he wrote all these backstories for all of the characters. And one of the fascinating things about this movie is just how specific the performances are. Mm-hmm. Like, they're weird, but the characters are making very, the actors are making very, very specific choices. Which leads to one of the questions from one of my friends, which is, my friend Derek said, what's the deal with the items that Humongous has in his pistol box? So Humongous has this pistol that he only brings out on special occasions because he's got a limited number of bullets in this pistol box. And there's like all these holes in the pistol box that bullets are put in. He only uses the pistol when he's really angry and wants to prove a point. It's full of there's a photograph from World War One.
Yeah.
Of a couple. Hold on, I have it. There was this whole article written about Humongous.
I thought it was just like his grandfather's pistol. That's what I got from that.
Here we go. A few pins from the Australian Army, a World War One era military photograph. Yeah, which looks like his grandparents or something, like you said. Many missing bullets, and a Prussian Totenkopf. And so it says, just by looking at this case, we know a lot about Humongous. We're led to believe he was once a soldier, which may explain why he has so many ex-policemen in his tribe. And in an 84 interview, George Miller confirmed that Humongous was written as having been a military man. But we also notice in shots of his head that he's missing all of his hair, but it looks like it was burned off. His head is very deformed. He's got a vein that they actually created to, you see it pulse at times. They said that it never worked. They were only able to get one shot of it actually pulsing the way it was supposed to. His ears are missing. And you don't know, so you don't really know, like, what happened to this guy? Like, who is he? Why is he so angry? But also, why is he so eloquent? Why does he give? He at one point gives the town that's under siege. He gives them, like, he's like, you know what? Just leave your stuff. Leave, and we'll just leave you alone. He keeps saying, like, I don't want to see any more bloodshed. We've all lost people. We don't need any more death. And we don't know if then he means it.
Why doesn't he just be like, why don't we just work together?
That's the question. What is the deal with Lord Humongous? This was from an article called The Complexity of Lord Humongous by Ron Welch from the Radlands website.
Was there... Did it seem like he and the... whatever the hell the leader guy from the other place's name was, did they know each other?
I think they definitely know each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they... I think that there's a history there. I am sure that if you looked at George Miller's... notes, there probably would be like a whole like backstory there for them.
Why is he German?
He's not German. He's Swedish. He was played by Kjell Nielsen, a Swedish Olympic class weightlifter and actor.
Then why is he Swedish?
Because he's big and they needed a big guy.
So there's no reason for Lord Humongous to be Swedish. He just is.
He just is. He is just Swedish. Maybe he just liked Sweden. At one point, you hear him quoting a poem called...
It was really out of left field, the two.
It's called Örkönig. It's a poem by Goethe. And it is a poem. It's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 stanza poem about a man carrying his child through the woods. You don't know why he's carrying him. But the child keeps saying that he sees the Örkönig, or the, like, elf king, and that the elf king keeps talking to him and asking him to come with him. And the father's like, you're just imagining it, you're just imagining it, you're just imagining it. And the elf king gets more and more insistent and tries to bribe the little boy. And then when the father gets to where they're going, to the farm or wherever, the little boy is dead in his arms.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why Humongous quotes this long poem. But it's another one of those very specific choices.
I mean, I'm sure there's probably academic papers written on the hints of backstory we get from Mad Max 2. That'd be a really interesting paper.
I think you know what your next paper is going to be.
Yeah, that would actually be really interesting.
Yeah. Come back.
Using context clues from the movie to put together the backstories of each of the key characters in Mad Max 2.
I think there is your next term paper. And I think it's perfect for you because that means you would get to live with Mad Max for weeks and weeks, just watching it over and over again.
Yeah, it'd actually be really interesting if Like, because, I mean, I would have a goal at that point, and I wouldn't have to just sit through the movie. I would actually be, like, paying attention. Plus, I think that knowing now that there's so much love put into the backstories of these characters by this guy, whatever his name is. I can't remember his name. Who made this movie?
George Miller?
Yeah, him. I think it makes me want to piece together what the actors were trying to do and what the actors were trying to portray.
Do it.
Okay, bye.
I'll pay you $5. So Mad Max... there's a ton of other characters in there. There's the toady who gets his fingers cut off by the...
He's the worst.
Yeah, he's the smart one. The smart one. He's the
smart one.
Right. You're saying that with
quotation mark
fingers. He gets his fingers cut off. He ends up getting blown up by Max's booby trapped car. There is Wes, we mentioned, whose boyfriend, a sub, I don't know who this guy was, gets killed by the feral boy. The feral kid, who lives underground in the tunnel system, is a little boy who doesn't speak, but who ends up
he's Frankenstein.
He's Frankenstein from Frankenstein Conquers the World. He also, you find out he is the one telling us this story as an old man. At the end of the movie, you find out that he is the narrator. You have Virginia Hay as Warrior Woman, who is sort of the beautiful woman with giant shoulder pads. You have Arky Whitley as the captain's girl, who the gyrocopter pilot, gyro captain, tries to convince to leave the compound. You have a bunch of other like action figures running around this place. But of course, the big characters in this movie are the vehicles. Mad Max's car, the Interceptor, is one of the most famous vehicles in film history. It appeared in the first movie, it appears in this movie, and it appears in the fourth movie, even though it's destroyed in this movie. It does not appear in the third movie. It's a
because
Ford
it was
Falcon.
Destroyed.
Because, it was a Ford Falcon XB Coupe. It is one of many interceptors in the first movie because Mad Max was a cop in the first movie. He's a police officer, his family gets killed. The cops drive around in these souped up cars called interceptors. And the fact that it's still surviving in this movie, although it has been changed a lot, is sort of a testament to how awesome these cars are supposed to be. Everyone wants an interceptor. In the first movie, the interceptor was just sort of a shell that was sort of made to look like a cool car. By this movie, they had actually souped it up so that it could drive super fast, so that it was sort of...
Because the first movie had zero budget, and this movie had a lot of budget.
The car became so famous that it was like toured around. It was like you would go to car shows, and like this car or like recreations of this car were always on display. They added two massive fuel tanks so that it could travel greater distances. They removed the front bumper so that it could travel off-road. They had removed the passenger seats. They added the custom seat for the dog, which is amazing.
I like the idea that Mad Max spent all of his extra time and energy making a custom seat for his dog.
Well, the dog wasn't just there as a friend. The dog there was the shotgun that was rigged to a bone. And if if the dog pulled the bone, it could fire the shotgun, I wish we'd gotten to see the dog use that bone shotgun.
The dog
and there's
was
weapons
amazing.
All throughout it. The car is booby-trapped so that if you try to steal the fuel, it will explode, which comes into play later on when Humongous's men try to steal the car try to steal the fuel and it explodes. Killing the toady guy who lost his fingers. And Humongous has a truck that he drives that has people strapped.
That is the least fuel-efficient vehicle in the entire movie.
A lot of these movies, I believe, a lot of these cars, I believe, are set up mostly to be intimidating. They're kind of like the AT-AT walkers in Empire Strikes Back. Like, they're bad at what they do, but they sure are scary to see coming at you.
You just got to, like, drive 10 miles and it'll be out of gas, and then you'll be, like, free to go.
Yeah, but you've got two people strapped to the front of your truck, so...
I don't want to be strapped to the front of the truck. Why would I want to slow down for that?
What do you mean?
I'm saying that if you are being chased by that truck, you just got to drive like 10 miles and then the truck will be out of gas and you'll be free to go.
But it also means that if your people are strapped to the front of that truck, you're afraid to do anything to it.
Like, I don't care. I'll kill him. Doesn't matter.
Oh my God. So heartless when it comes to your
friends
in the wasteland.
If I am in a post-apocalyptic world and I see two of my friends strapped to the front of a truck, they're dead already. I don't care.
Oh my goodness. Remind me not to be on your team. Daddy's dead already.
It wouldn't matter. I would have hung myself the first week of the apocalypse.
That's true. Again, like, you are not looking at two people who would make it to the Mad Max 2 part of the apocalypse.
No.
Yeah, we are. My body has been processed and turned into dippity-doo dog food or whatever by this point. Dinky-die.
I still like the idea that it's only Australia that's this effed up from this situation.
Right.
Because it's Australia. It's just it's, like everyone else is like, we'll just let Australia do what it's doing, I guess.
So really quick, I just want to cover this really quick, is that Max takes this person to this place. He's like, give me fuel in exchange for this guy. He's held captive by the compound for a while. He says, look, I know where there is a truck that can pull this gigantic tanker and get you guys out of here. Give me some fuel. I'll carry it to this truck under secret of night. I'll drive it back here, and then you guys can escape. He does that. He has to crash through the bad guys with the truck. He gets back to the compound. He leaves at one point. He gets severely injured. He gets rescued by the gyrocopter guy, taken back to the compound. He was supposed to drive the truck for them. He's too banged up. The leader is going to drive the truck, but then he gets injured, so Max is going to drive the truck.
That's not what happened.
What happened?
What happened was he brings the truck back and they're like, you should drive this for us. And he's like, no, just give me the fuel and I'm going to go. And they're like, fine, right, whatever. Then he goes and the bad guys attack him because he's all alone and the dog gets killed and he's really badly injured. And the gyrocopter guy rescues him. Then he gets taken back to the compound. And now that his dog's been killed by the bad guys, he's like, I'll drive this truck for you.
Right.
And the leader's like, no. And he's like, yes, I'm going to drive this truck for you. You have no choice. That's what happened.
And they're like, you're so banged up, you can barely drive a wheelchair, which is one of my favorite lines. And he's all, I'm going to do it. And they're like, fine. So they set up the truck with the tanker to drive in one direction. They surround it with a bunch of their cars to protect it. And then a bunch of the other people are loaded into a school bus that's sent off in another direction.
Yep.
Knowing full well that the bad guys are going to chase the tanker truck. And so this will save the sort of like presumably the weaker members of the group, keep them out of danger. And it works. Max is chased by the bad guys. There is an extended.
Everyone protecting him is dead.
Everyone gets killed who tries to protect Max, who's driving this. The warrior woman, the leader, the Papagallo, the smart guy, the engineer guy. They've souped up this whole thing with swords and crossbows and
not wheel guards though.
Not wheel guards. Yeah, we were like, why don't they just cover the wheels? Like a little bit more cover for the wheels would be nice. But
yep.
There is an incredibly long chase sequence. It's incredibly well done.
It's just very long.
It's very long. Everyone gets killed. Lord Humongous gets killed. And the tanker itself is completely destroyed, gets knocked over on its side. Max gets out. Everyone's dead. Oh, and the feral boy is there with him.
He doesn't die.
He does not die either. In fact, he helps save Max's life. Max is given the last of the shotgun shells to protect himself, and the shotgun shells spill out onto the hood of the truck, and the feral boy has to go get them for Max, who uses them to save the day. Max crashes, he gets out, he looks and finds out that the fuel tanker is not actually filled with fuel. What is it filled with?
Sand.
It was the decoy. The fuel is actually in the school bus that has been driven in the other direction. It's kind of a brilliant switcheroo.
And somehow Faraboy ended up with a school bus. I think there was a rendezvous point that they were supposed to meet together at that Max brings him to, and then Max takes off.
Yep, and they're like, stay with us. He's like, no. He walks off. He's going to be alone for the rest of his life. And then the feral boy is like, I knew that guy. I was that feral boy. I ended up becoming the leader of the northern tribes.
After the gyrocopter guy was the leader of the northern tribes.
What?
Because gyrocopter takes over for Papa whatever. Oh, yeah. Gyrocopter guy doesn't die. He's one of the protectors who does not die.
Yes. And at one point he tries to convince the young woman to go off with him. She sticks around. You what?
Really matter. That part doesn't really matter.
Well, it's his change of heart too. The captain's girl. She's known as the captain's girl because she sticks with the gyro. The gyro captain is in love with her. He tries to convince her to leave. She says no. So he decides to stay there as well and help out. And then he becomes the leader of the group. Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, there's no way he's smarter than anyone else there, but
he has a gyrocopter.
He does have the gyrocopter. And Max goes off on his own. And you've got these just great characters, these very cartoony Saturday morning type characters out there in the wasteland.
In a movie that doesn't deserve them.
Doesn't deserve what?
The characters.
So the question is, of course, what is Guillermo del Toro's connection to this movie?
He likes big cars.
And he cannot lie.
Yeah. I mean, look at Pacific Rim.
There's a great interview. It's a roundtable discussion that was done by THR that featured Guillermo del Toro, Greta Gerwig, Patty Jenkins, Denis Villeneuve, Angelina Jolie, and Joe Wright, just talking about movies and talking about the things they love about movies. And, you know, what got them started in the business. And Guillermo del Toro gets asked, you know, like, what's the movie that kind of changed your life that made you want to be a filmmaker?
I have a question. I have a question. Does he give a different answer to this question every time he's asked it?
He addresses that. And he's like, I'm going to give a different answer every time I'm asked that, basically. Because, you know, it depends on, you know, like, what do you even mean by that? Like, what does that even mean? But he says, my answer is going to be pretty lowbrow. And he says, it's The Road Warrior. And people are like, oh, I thought it was going to be Frankenstein. Like, everyone's like, oh, I thought it was going to be Frankenstein.
Oh, he's already explained Frankenstein several hundred times.
But he says, like, ask me one day and it'll be Frankenstein. Ask me another day, it's The Road Warrior. He says he saw The Road Warrior when he was a teenager. And it was the first movie he ever saw where he was fully aware of the choices the filmmaker was making. He suddenly saw that filmmaking was just like painting and just like a dance. Like every choice, every camera movement, every bit of camera placement, the colors you use, the soundscape, everything is part of the art. And it was suddenly he realized what filmmaking was. Like it just it amazed him. He's watched The Road Warrior a million times, and every time he's amazed by the cinematography, by the sets, by the costume, like how everything is a specific choice being made to tell this wild story. And
you know, it's funny. This movie is so good, like when it comes to like the technical stuff, but I just can't care about it.
And to me, that's where it comes down to, like, just personal preference and, you know, what affects you as a person observing art. There's just certain things that just are never going to resonate with you, and that's fine.
I just don't care about cars.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. Like, you don't have to. I think what's great about you and where your journey has taken you during the course of this whole podcast is that you're able to go, you know what, this is a fantastic movie, and I cannot stand watching it. Like, you just, this doesn't appeal to me. I've been watching a lot of folk horror. I've been on lockdown. I have 10 days in isolation because I had COVID. Still do, apparently. I tested positive again this morning. I'm not sick. I'm still infected. But I've been watching a lot of stuff. And one of the things I've been watching is a lot of folk horror. And the three seminal folk horror movies, called the trio, is Witch Finder General, Blood on Satan's Claw, and The Wicker Man. Mm-hmm. And I've seen Wicker Man a few times, and I watched Blood on Satan's Claw, and I was like, hell yeah, awesome movie. Time to pop in Witchfinder General. And I got a quarter of the way through, and I was like, absolutely not. This movie is not for me. It's not mostly, but it has a lot of torture in it. It's about a witch finder. It's a true story about the witch finder general, like torturing people during the witch hunts in Europe, even though he was kind of acting on his own and like did not have the official like say so of the government or anything. He was rogue. He was doing it a lot for money. But in any case, it's horrific. From the 60s, it's very graphic, and you know where it's leading. Because nothing good ever comes of this. And I was just like, you know what? I don't need to watch this. I acknowledge this is a brilliant movie. It's beautifully made. Vincent Price is terrifying and amazing in it. I'm at a point in my life where this is not for me. This is not a movie I want to watch. And life is too short for me right now.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way about that. I'm like, if I had to watch it for this show, I would watch it. But I'm like, this is my free time. We watched The Devils, very hard movie. A similar movie to The Devils, as a matter of fact. Like, it's a very smart, very passionate movie about a very important subject, about the hypocrisy of the church, yada, yada, yada. But I was like, I don't need to watch this, even though I know it's a good movie. It's a well-made movie. So yeah, I'm right there with you. Like, I would watch The Road Warrior because I enjoy this kind of, I enjoy action, I enjoy the visceral nature of it. But no, of course you don't have to watch this. Of course you don't have to, like, say it's something you enjoy. Full stop.
Yeah.
We are smart people. We are good people.
I like the dog.
Again, as we said during Crimson Peak, you don't have to watch a movie.
Yeah,
that's our rule. You do not have to. If it makes you uncomfortable, stop watching it. There are so many movies in this world. Watch something else. Don't watch anything. Heck.
Careful, the internet's going to get really mad at you.
You don't have to watch a movie. But Guillermo del Toro loves this movie. It basically kickstarted his passion for making films. And the question is, they asked, they're like, so do you know George Miller? And he's like, yeah, I know George. Like, he loves George Miller. And in fact, George Miller helped Guillermo del Toro, while he was filming Nightmare Alley, he had to take 6 weeks off because of lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And what got him through lockdown was he and Steven Spielberg and George Miller would just text each other every day, movie trivia, and try to stump each other. They'd send stills from movies to each other and be like, what movie is this? And like, whoever got it first, like, would win. Like, they would just play movie trivia games and they would chat, and Guillermo del Toro would ask questions like, George Miller, were you deliberately homaging Steven Spielberg's Duel at this point in Mad Max?
I made a duel joke at the beginning of Mad Max, didn't I?
You did. And George Miller was like, holy crap, I guess I was. Yeah. Like, I'd seen Duel. I didn't even realize I was homaging it at this point. But yes, absolutely, that's an homage to Duel.
I want to see the Duel man, the Duel car man in Mad Max, just driving.
You said that, it gave me this image of I can't even think of the actor's name all of a sudden, but behind the car, the wheel of his little car, being like, leave me alone, the whole movie. What's funny is, in 2017, Guillermo del Toro said that he was starting a project where he was going to interview Michael Mann. And he was going to interview George Miller for 3 weeks each about filmmaking. It was his new project. He was going on sabbatical, and he was going to do this super project where he was going to interview both those filmmakers and then publish, or something, their interviews. And he talked about this a lot. Like, it got a lot of press. Like, Guillermo del Toro interviewing Michael Mann. Guillermo del Toro interviewing George Miller. 3-week-long interviews. Is this his next big project? And nothing ever seemed to come of it. Like, we don't know whatever happened to it. Like,
whatever happened to any of the projects that he said he was going to make that haven't made it off the ground?
Like, it's just amazing that I would love.
Except for Pinocchio, apparently.
Except for Pinocchio. And we finally got a Nightmare Alley. But yeah, like, who knows whatever happened. I would love to just see him sit down with George Miller. But to answer your question, yes, he knows George Miller. He's a big fan of George.
I didn't ask
Miller.
You if he knew George Miller.
To answer the world's question. And in that round table, the person running it said, if you had one question to ask George Miller, what would it be? And without any hesitation, Guillermo del Toro said, do you like me? That's the one question he wants to know from George Miller. Is, do you like me? Like, seriously, do you really like me? That interview happened around the time of The Shape of Water, which is why they had the big round table. George Miller, if you're listening, do you like Guillermo del Toro, or are you just like blowing smoke up his butt? Like, is
Guillermo del Toro, if you're listening, come give a lecture at Augsburg, please.
Guillermo del Toro,
I want to get a film lecture from you.
Please come to my house and stand outside the window and yell up to me. You can't come in. I have COVID. Just please come and yell hello to me. But that's the Road Warrior. Listeners, if you're listening at all, I hope we covered all the topics people wanted us to cover. The dog is adorable.
Also a good boy.
There were action figures made of the characters eventually, not at the time, but eventually. The gyrocopter captain does have an action figure made that does come with a snake.
Does not
come with a gyrocopter.
We did a lot of research into gyrocopters while we were watching this movie.
You were all over the gyrocopter. So do you still want a gyrocopter?
You were the one who said you wanted a gyrocopter to fly around the city. What do you mean?
Do you want a gyrocopter?
No, I can't trust myself with a skateboard.
You can get a gyrocopter's license. Like, you can get a license.
I don't have a driver's license. What do you think?
$few thousand.
Actually, I'm less likely to crash into someone else on a gyrocopter than I am to crash into someone else on a car. Maybe I should get a gyrocopter to fly around instead of a...
But you're more likely to crash into things like a building or a tree or a power line.
No, pretty much the same amount of probability there.
If you got a gyrocopter and I didn't know it, and then one day I'm looking out my window and you're like hovering...
That'd be scary. Mate.
So yeah, so this movie did really well overseas and in Australia.
This is a movie that would do well in America.
I believe at the time it was the most, maybe, no, Mad Max was like the most profitable independent film at the time or something, or international independent film, something like that. But yeah, it cost $4.5 million to make. It grossed $36 million.
I wish I had $36 million. I wish I had $1 million.
So it made its money back. It was well received even at the time. It wasn't one of those movies that slowly gained its following. It was pretty much a hit right off the bat. George Miller went on to make a segment in Twilight Zone, the movie, speaking of gyrocopters, speaking of helicopters. He went on to make Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, which was another big hit, which I think was the first Mad Max movie I ever saw. Then he did Witches of Eastwick. Okay. Then he did Lorenzo's Oil. All right. Then he wrote Babe. Then he directed the documentary 40,000 Years of Dreaming. Then he made Babe, Pig in the City. Then he made Happy Feet.
Yep.
Then he made Happy Feet 2. And we were like, all right. Then he took some time off. He took a lot of time off between projects. And then he made Mad Max Fury Road. And we were like, okay.
Nice.
Now he has
Then he made Happy Feet 3.
No. Now he has an epic fantasy romance film called 3,000 Years of Longing coming out, starring Idris Elba and Tilda Swinton, where Idris Elba plays a djinn who offers Tilda Swinton 3 wishes. And it apparently is in post-production. And then he has Furiosa, the prequel to Mad Max, which is in pre-production.
You're going to say Fursona for a second. Nope.
Furiosa. Like,
it's Mad Max, but they're all furries.
The prequel to Fury Road, which is apparently going to get made, starring Anna Taylor-Joy as Furiosa.
The prequel
to the sequel.
To Fury Road.
Yes.
Which one is Fury Road?
The fourth Mad Max.
So it's the prequel to Fury Road, so it should be the fourth one, but it's actually going to be the fifth one.
Right. It's about Furiosa, how she became Furiosa.
I don't remember that movie at all. I was like 12 when I saw it.
Furiosa, she's like basically the lead in Mad Max Fury Road. She's the woman with the dark makeup across her eyes. George Miller is also very old at this point, unfortunately. I mean, very old. He's 76. But he's pushing it. He's getting up there. So please, George Miller, please make more and more films. Yeah. This movie is available on Blu-ray. Buy it. It's got a great commentary track by George Miller and the cinematographer of Fury Road, Dean Semler. They are chums. They are buddies. They are fun to listen to. You find out that this movie was filmed during the winter. Everyone was so cold that they had to wrap themselves up in furs when the cameras weren't running, that Mel Gibson's teeth were chattering, and he would stop them from chattering as soon as the cameras went on, and then he would start chattering his teeth again as soon as his takes were done. It was very cold, which I guess is better than it being very hot.
It didn't look very cold in the movie, so props to that, I guess.
Props to that. You couldn't see their breath, but apparently it was
It looked really warm in the movie.
Yeah. Mad Max 2, everyone. We covered it. Willow, what is our next movie gonna be?
Finally, Jesus. It's gonna be Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, and if it's not, I'm gonna murder you.
We're finally covering Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. We're gonna cover Scary Stories, maybe another produced by Guillermo del Toro movie. There's a couple that we skipped that might be worth looking into. But definitely doing Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. We've got some kick-awesome movies coming up on our list after that, but definitely doing Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Because if we don't, I'm gonna murder you.
You're gonna murder me as if you were some kind of horrific ghost that I have accidentally brought into my high school bathroom. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, ladies and gentlemen. So pop in your DVD of that in preparation for the next episode. Do you have anything else to add? Do you have anything else you want to say? Can our listeners find you anywhere, Willow?
No.
Anything you're excited about for school?
No.
I have other podcasts, Deep in Bear Country, Berenstain Bearcast, and Pizza Toast, Babysitter's Club podcast, which is gearing up to start up again with The Princess Diaries.
We will have to take a break in March. A couple weeks. Because I'll be in Italy.
You'll be in Italy. Bella, bella.
You've made that joke every time I've said that.
It's the only Italian word I know. So stay tuned for more movies. Stay tuned for another break, which you're used to. The show is so weird and sporadic. But thanks for listening to Mad Max. Thanks for listening. Woo. Oh, it also had great music. I really enjoyed the music.
I don't remember the music.
By Brian May. So that's it. I'm Phil.
Who... I'm Willow.
We'll see.
It's Del Toro time.
I cut you off.
That what I was gonna say has absolutely nothing to do with the show. We can discuss it afterwards.
Oh, well then I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.